Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our final thing session of the year. It's been an excellent year, and thank you all of you who've been coming to our seminars. Welcome if this is your first visit to Things. We're really happy to say we have secured funding for next year, so there'll be a whole year more of Things ahead, which you'll hear more about in the future. But for now, on to the matter at hand today. For the hotly anticipated sexy things, we've been really looking forward to this one ever since we got the titles back in summer last year. It seems like a long time ago. So as is our usual format, I'll introduce both speakers, then Jen will come up first to speak, will follow immediately after, and then there'll be a joint Q&A discussion session at the end. So, you know, save up your questions, have a think about how the papers intersect, reflect on one another and where perhaps they diverge, and we should have a good discussion at the end. So Dr. Jennifer Evans is a senior lecturer in early modern history at the University of Hertfordshire. Her research focuses on the body, medicine, sexual health, reproduction and gender from 1550 to 1750. She's published articles widely in Women's History Review and the Social History of Medicine. And her first monograph, which many of us know in the room, is on aphrodisiacs, fertility and medicine in early modern English. Early modern England, and was published in October 2014. Jen's now working on her second monograph, which examines men's sexual health in the 17th century. And with Sarah Reed, she runs an excellent blog, which I really recommend. It's earlymodernmedicine.com, so do check it out if you haven't yet. And she will be speaking today on Kindling Cupid's Fire, Aphrodisiacs in Early Modern England. She will be followed by Professor Will Fisher, who joins us from the English department at CUNY, so all the way from New York. Will's currently working on two book-length projects, but he's talking to us today about a chapter of the first, which is his book on sexual practices in early modern English culture. So there's chapters on kissing, intercrural sex, cunnilingus, the use of dildos, which we'll be hearing about today, and flogging. So we can all keep our eyes open for that one.
Boring.
Boring stuff, yeah. In addition to his monograph, which again many of us in the room know and love, Materialising Gender in Early Modern English Literature and Culture, which won the 2006 Best Book Award from the Society for the Study of Early Modern Women, Will has published widely on fascinating topics such as codpieces, beards, handkerchiefs and queering the Renaissance. His paper is delightfully titled Dr. Dildo's Dancing School, Sexual Instruments and Women's Erotic Agency in England, circa 1600 to 1725. And I have two handouts which accompany Will's paper, which if we could pass around now, I would really appreciate. So
all this stuff is on like PowerPoint too, so if there's this party saver or something.
Yeah, take home. And if you're tweeting, I encourage you to tag us. We're at Cambridge Things, and we've got the hashtag EMThings. Also, I've forgotten the sign-in book today. So today we're going to have to sign a piece of paper, but it will be accompanied by some really delightful images on the back. So please do put your name. And if you haven't signed up to our mailing list, but you would like to, include your email address on there as well. So I'd like to invite Jen up, and we will get her PowerPoint up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me, everyone. I should confess now that I'm not really a material cultures person, so this is probably the first time I've ever thought about the aphrodisiacs I've been looking at for 7 years as material things and objects, so you might have to bear with me a little bit. It was common knowledge in early modern England that sexual desire was malleable and could be increased by eating a range of foods, including artichokes, oysters, parsnips, and cantharides. As the 17th century ballad, The London Cuckold, suggested of one couple, when he came home, she gave him kisses, and sack posset very good, cordials too she never misses, for they warm and heat the blood, such things will create desire, and new kindle Cupid's fire. These things make him kiss his wife, and to call her love and life. These foods were thought to work in a range of ways, but were united by the fact that they were simultaneously both raised libido and improved fertility. In this paper, I want to outline some of the main ways in which aphrodisiacs were thought to work in this era, before considering some of the ways in which they might have been approached as things that matter, as foods that were eaten, gifts that were given, and as physical objects. Thinking of aphrodisiacs as material objects is in some ways rather complicated. In particular, it's complicated by the fact that they're inherently ephemeral, grown or produced, manufactured and manipulated, and consumed, leaving few traces of their existence outside of textual sources. Moreover, as Anne Gerritsen and Giorgio Riello have explained, the meanings attached to objects develop through relationships that can be both individual and personal, and collective and public. For these particular objects, accessing the personal and individual relationships can be very difficult. Few people left traces of their own interactions with these substances, although we do get the occasional glimpse, like the brief note in a manuscript collection of medical recipes that southernwood, being laid under the bed's head, doth provoke venery. Yet it is perhaps important to consider aphrodisiacs as things. The idea that objects are tools through which people shape their lives is eminently appropriate to thinking about a medicinal substance designed principally to transform childless couples into expectant parents, and it's that that I want to focus on today. For ease of discussion, I'm going to describe several discrete taxonomies of aphrodisiacs, but it's important to note at the beginning that medicinal substances in early modern England were rarely specifics. They rarely functioned in just one way or were applicable to just one disease. It was often thought that aphrodisiacs contained multiple virtues and worked in lots of different ways at the same time. Varied intellectual frameworks guided these understandings. Medical writers utilised both the humoral model, where contrary substances were used to cure diseases, and drew on ideas of sympathy and the doctrine of signatures to understand other types of aphrodisiacs. It's also important to note that although a few aphrodisiacs enjoyed near ubiquitous fame, things like oysters, lambstones, satyrion, and artichokes, some foods' kind of designation as an aphrodisiac was very contested, and it certainly wasn't consistent. Lots of different books will name different things, and another book will disregard the same thing. And particularly towards the end of the era that I look at and into the 18th century, as new ideas about the anatomy of the reproductive organs started to come through, various types of aphrodisiacs were rejected as being ineffective. So fundamentally, aphrodisiacs worked on two levels to promote fertility. The first was simply that they increased libido, which facilitated the circumstances in which conception could happen. Pleasure was crucial to this, and discussions of aphrodisiacs in medical texts often blurred descriptions of libido and pleasure. Several medical writers noted that without intercourse, and thus without libido and pleasure, the human race would cease to exist. Perhaps the most vociferous pronouncement of this was made by John Martin in the early 18th century, and this is quite possibly my most favourite quote ever. He explained that God Almighty has endured each sex with natural instincts, prompting them to use thereof with desire in order to perpetuate the species, by producing new creatures to supply the room of those who are gone. Without which desire, what rational creature would have taken delight in so filthy, so contemptible and base a thing as venery is? And indeed, had not nature tacked more than an ordinary pleasing sensation and desire to each sex in the act, by giving those parts such a quick and tender sense and transporting titillation, and which with all the artillery of reason we're not able to control, so furious is our passion for the embrace, we should have no manner of incitement to, or inclination to the performing of it, and consequently, procreation must soon cease and be at an end. A little bit melodramatic, one might think. Secondly, though, throughout the era, medical writers were rather emphatic about the fact that aphrodisiacs improved the fecundity of the body. In many chapters in medical texts describing the cures for barrenness, they would note that substances discussed in separate chapters on improving libido were relevant. For example, the posthumous edition of Felix Platter's A Golden Practice of Physic from 1662 stated that the things mentioned to provoke lust are chiefly used for conception. So what were aphrodisiacs and how did they work? Well, they worked in several different ways, and I'm now going to take some time to go through each of those. Firstly, aphrodisiacs raised the heat of the body and created lust and desire. But they also created the optimal conditions in both the male seed and in the womb for conception. In the humoral system, bodies that were cold were described as frigid, unable to feel pleasure, and unable to procreate. Popular works like Nicholas Culpepper's Directory for Midwives informed its audience that the fourth cause of natural barrenness was, quote, a loss of carnal copulation. When, quote, men and women come to the school of Venus either not at all or so frigidly that never as good, never a whit as never the better. This is perpetually caused of a cold distemper. These bodies needed to have their temperature raised, but this was a delicate balancing act, as overly hot bodies were also thought to be infertile, as the heat consumed and burned away the potent elements of the seed. Jacob Ruff's medical text thus advised women who were, quote, hindered very much for a desire to be acquainted with Venus, that they should take heating herbs such as galangale, rocket, pepper, ginger, and cinnamon. And you're going to have an awful lot of foods thrown at you in the next 10 minutes or so, just go with it. They're all aphrodisiacs to early morning people. Philip Barrow likewise recommended that frigid men and women should use, quote, meats that do heat and engender good humours, as is the flesh of hens, capons, partridges, pheasants, young doves, birds of mountains, and especially sparrows, cockstones, and such like. The most infamous of heating aphrodisiacs was the Spanish fly, or Cantharides. These small insects were infamous both for their stimulating properties and for the exceptional danger that they posed to the body. Cantharides were ubiquitously understood to heat the body and were recommended by medical authors in severe cases of sterility. However, it was widely acknowledged that they could overheat and blister the body, both internally and externally, if they weren't used carefully. And so medical writers repeatedly cautioned against the misuse of this potent remedy. In her 17th century midwifery manual, Jane Sharp warned that the consumption of cantharides to stimulate an erection could result in a priapism, or a continual standing of the yard, which she went on to say was more problematic than if it never stood at all. The dangers were normally elucidated through gruesome case studies. Theophile Bonnet, for example, recorded that, quote, I have known several, and among the rest two noblemen, who used cantharides, the one to gratify his whore and the other his new married wife, but wholly with ill success, for the first fell into a most dangerous pissing of blood, of which he was cured with a great difficulty, and the other, the second day after he was married, died of an apoplexy. Many foods that heated the body were also thought to provide excellent nourishment. This was necessary because food was converted inside the body into blood, which was then further elaborated into seed in the testicles. Hot foods were considered to be easy to digest and as well as nourishing. And potent seed not only enhanced the chances of conception, but stimulated desire and sexual pleasure as it moved through the reproductive organs. In the 1662 edition of the Golden Practice of Physic, there was a substantial list of these types of foods provided. And they wrote, to correct a want of copulation, we give things that cause seed. And this, as we said, by its plenty and sharpness, stirs up a desire to the act and disposes the members for it. These are such as cause much blood, which is the matter from which seed is made. The authors also explained that foods that nourished were white and full of marrow, and that these provoked lust and included things such as the brains, stones, and flesh of crawfish, crabs, lobsters, oysters, cuttlefish, polypus, cocks, quails, sparrows, and foxes, as well as milk, eggs, chestnuts, parsnips, almonds, pine nuts, pistachios, artichokes, rapes, beans, peas, rice, and barley. Take your pick. In addition to describing nourishing foods, medical writers also wrote about a slightly different category, which they called seed provokers. And I think the use of this label in some places is just to be very clear about what the food is doing. But I also think in some cases they're separate groups. So some foods provide nourishment that the body can produce seed from, and others provoke the body to make seed out of nourishment that's already in the body. So Philip Barrow, in addition to all of those recommendations, argued that it is convenient that you give unto such as desire to get children some accustomed pleasant thing to eat or drink before meat, which be most apt to provoke carnal lust and to engender seed. And Felix Platter, who, having given the huge list we've already seen, offered more similar advice and suggested that foods that worked in this particular way were onions, leeks, mushrooms, rocket, colewort, and asparagus. Seed was thought to tickle and titillate as it passed through the body, and this virtue was in the 16th and 17th centuries generally attributed to the salty nature of the seed. Thus, brackish foods were also thought to improve the quality of seed and cause increased desire, pleasure, and potency. Isbrand van Diemerbroek, for example, explained that salt, by reason of its heat and acrimony, provokes to lust those that used to eat it in any great quantity. And for this cause, the Egyptian priests were wont to abstain from all manner of salt meats, having found by experience that salt things do cause a kind of itching or tickling in those parts that serve for generation. Similarly, in the Mercurius Compitalitius of 1684, Theophile Barnet wrote that saline and acrimonious things were aphrodisiacs, and because, as he said, for Venus is said to be born of the salt sea, so saline things notably stimulate. But this was a very contested area, and particularly in the 18th century, authors started to question whether salt was really an aphrodisiac. John Martin argued that some impute the cause of this pleasure to the salt of the seed, but I do not believe seed is possessed of such a quantity of salts sufficient to prick the parts through which it passes and to cause such an agreeable titillation. What I think is really interesting about Martin is he's not directly saying salt isn't stimulating, he's just saying there isn't enough of it in seed for that to be a cause of libido. So all of the virtues I've discussed so far were thought to cause libido and fertility in both the male and the female body. But one kind of aphrodisiac was explicitly used for the male body alone, and indeed was thought to be very damaging to the female reproductive system. And these are windy meats or flatulent foods. Medical authors explained that an erection was caused by blood, imagination, muscles, pressure, seed, and wind inflating the penis. Consequently, it was believed that foods that released wind into the body better enabled men to have an erection. This, however, does facilitate female pleasure because women's colder bodies need longer to become heated and to experience arousal, so the longer a man can last, the better it is for women's pleasure. This flatulent category was also important because potent seed was thought to contain windy spirits, which pushed it through the male body and into the female reproductive organs, again facilitating both the experience of pleasure but also facilitating conception. The most notable food in this category tends to be peas and beans, but other things do crop up. Philip Barrow argued that when a man could not fulfil his marital duties, he should make use of windy meats that are good for him, as be chickpeas and beans, scallions, leeks, the roots and seeds of parsnips, pine nuts, sweet almonds, and other such like. Jacques Ferrand's treatise on erotic melancholy also listed foods that were potentially flatulent and provoked sexual desire, and again he gave another very long list. Pine nuts, pistachios, small nuts, chives, artichokes, coleworts, rapes, carrots, parsnips, green ginger, oringos, satyrion, onions, waternuts, rocket, oysters, chestnut, chickpeas, and all such like meats, which is a nice all-encompassing category. Like salty foods, though, windy meats were a rather contentious group, and as the period progressed, medical writers, increasingly influenced by new understandings of the male genitalia, rejected windy meats as aphrodisiacs. Theophile Bonnet dismissed the opinions of other medical writers and confidently stated that windy meats were detrimental to all generative bodies. He wrote, "It is commonly reported of aphrodisiacs that flatus or wind is necessary to venery. But though in boys, erection or distension of the penis may seem to be from flatus, and these may concur by accident, yet they cannot nor ought not to be reckoned amongst aphrodisiacs. Those things that excite the spirits and stir up venery and so make the seed turgid, but so do not those things that breed and excite wind." These groups of aphrodisiacs all functioned within the humoral model. They cured by contrary or supplied something that was lacking in the body. They heated those that were cold. They gave wind to those who didn't have any. But concurrently in this era, medical writers and others also advocated aphrodisiacs that worked by sympathy or through the doctrine of signatures. These stimulants were thought to work through occult or hidden virtues and were often identifiable by the outward appearance of the plants or animals from which they were taken. One 17th century medical author, Richard Bunworth, eloquently explained how this premise operated. He said, The good and wise maker of the universe hath created all things after so glorious and beautiful a manner, and has given to each creature such an exact comeliness after its kind, that there is not any one thing in the whole world whose outward lineaments do not truly justly characterize unto man its inward endowments. In particular, medical writers advocated the consumption of animal genitalia, especially from animals considered to be lusty or potent. Consuming the animal parts was thought to transfer the vitality of the animals from which they came to the consumer, and so the testicles of bulls, boars, goats and stags, as well as their pizzle or penis, was recommended in numerous recipes. The matrix or womb of a hare was also frequently discussed for women. The brains and bodies of small animals were also commonly thought to be aphrodisiacs for the same reason. The 1651 edition of the Directory for Midwives explained this premise, and Nicholas Culpepper wrote, "Whatsoever any creature is addicted extremely to, they move the man that eats them to the like. Therefore partridges, quails, sparrows, etc., being exceedingly addicted to venery, they work the same in those men and women who eat them." The doctrine of signatures also applied to plants, and particularly those that had phallic shapes or that resembled the testicles. Oswald Kroll included a chapter on the plants that resembled the testicles, or stones as he described them, separately from a chapter in his book on plants that resembled the penis. And his book is all about the doctrine of signatures, and he goes through each part of the body and lists different plants that look like it. For those that resembled the testicles, he nearly universally described them all as exciters of the venereal faculty. Seems to have been a fan of that phrase. He also noted that some plants looked like particular parts of the male anatomy rather than the male genitalia as a whole. And again, we come back to beans. Notably, beans and acorns resembled the glands of the penis. Kroll did not suggest in his book that this made them an aphrodisiac, but readers of William Salmon's Botanologia in 1710 were informed that a strong broth of beans stirred up lust and was good for impotency in the male kind, who have not the power to use the act of generation, both because they were nutritious and windy, as we've already seen, and because, quote, by reason the bean, especially the field kind, has the signature of the glands of the penis, by which Pythagoras and his followers judged them to provoke lust. The particular focus on the similarity to the testicles in early modern medical texts emphasises that aphrodisiacs were really about conception, not just about libido. The testicles, after all, were what produced seed, which led to conception. The most popular of these types of plants is the one that you can see on my slide here. Certain breeds of orchis, known as dog stones, fool stones or fox stones, I'm sure I don't need to explain where the name comes from. The one you can see on the board is the most popular. It's called dog stones. And in his work on curing illness through the doctrine of signatures, Richard Bunworth mentioned only one aphrodisiac, and it was the roots of Ceterion, or dog stones, which represent the testicles in figure and are famous for their extimulation to venery. This plant's reputation endured throughout the early modern period. However, the overarching idea of the doctrine of signatures seems to start disappearing from descriptions of aphrodisiacs in the early 18th century. So those are the main categories of aphrodisiacs. They're what people thought worked. So I want to turn for the rest of my paper now to think a little bit about how people might have engaged with them as things that matter. As I've emphasised already, far from being frivolous sexual curiosities, which I sometimes think they get labelled as today, for early modern people, these foods could really matter. They facilitated a transition from a barren and infertile state to one of parenthood. In this way, they helped women and men fulfil their expected social roles and helped them to avoid scorn and ridicule. Laura Gowing has demonstrated that sexual slander included insults about infertility. Amongst women, having children could bring status, and so one London woman could insult her neighbour by saying, "I have 10 children and thou never hast a one." Men too were ridiculed, predominantly for impotence, but also for the underlying infertility that it implied. Again, Gowing records how one Essex man sued a neighbour for saying he had no prick to get a child. These insults were reinforced by contemporary literature and ballads. In The Sorrowful Bride, a young woman is married to a husband with no libido, and she complains at length in the ballad. And here is a sorrow which trouble me sore, as having my maidenhead now to this day, it is not enough to make me run astray. Alas, I am almost weary of life, for to live a maiden, though a married wife. These ballads ridiculed predominantly men's sexual incapacity, but they also underlined that women married to such men couldn't be made mothers and would never experience the joys of motherhood. One husband in The Contented Cuckold, for example, who was unable to father a child, was mocked repeatedly, and it says, all his old cronies did laugh his to scorn. In The Fumbler's Hall, the wives of insufficient husbands were also portrayed as vulnerable to, quote, the taunts and jeers of my neighbours who call me Baron Doe. We can also see that in some ballads, it was expected that women's responses to this situation would involve the use of aphrodisiacs. In The Woman's Brawl, the protagonist Dole complains, thou unnatural clown thou, feeble dick thou, as I'm an honest woman, neighbour, I went like a fool and made him a cordial with turkey eggs and afterwards a tansy with new-laid eggs from a hen trod by a game cock, put in comfrey and clary and fed him lamb stones, caviar and potato pies, yet he could do no more good to a woman than a boy of a year old. As in this tale, aphrodisiacs were in the popular mentality quite often ineffective. Ballads, I think, find this the funnier outcome, that people are eating all of these foods and they're never working. But also in Shakespeare's plays, they often don't always work either. Despite this, though, they were fundamentally a thing that in theory, if not in practice, could drastically change someone's lifestyle and standing in the community. If they worked and helped you conceive a child, they were truly a thing that mattered. Now, before we get too hung up on the motherhood and fertility section, it's worth pointing out that despite widespread understandings that aphrodisiacs improved the chances of conception, society did understand that people would consume them in a frivolous and, as they termed it, illicit manner. In these instances, aphrodisiacs shifted from being illicit medical substances to something a little bit more dubious. John Martin, for example, cautioned readers of Gynecologium Novum in the early 18th century that, quote, old lechers thinking to improve their former prowess and young gallants willing to merit their missus' goodwill do oftentimes misapply those medicines. In these illicit cases, aphrodisiacs were not simply medicines consumed by a knowing patient, but were often a substance that was given from one person to another. Laura Gowing has again shown that luxurious foods, including aphrodisiacs, appeared in some trial testimonies relating to attempted seductions. And in one case, she gives the example of Peter Marsh, who'd been twice at the house of a young woman and would have her abroad with him to eat artichokes and drink wine, and further that he would have plucked her down into his lap and put his hands under her coat, but that she would not suffer him. So again, either she didn't eat them or they didn't work, but his intentions seem to be quite clear to me. Likewise, as I've already suggested, some men misappropriated cantharides for purely lustful purposes. In this context, aphrodisiacs moved from being medicinal substances to quite a dangerous poison. John Quincy warned his readers with the story of a man who, quote, by taking a large dose inwardly, so inflamed himself that though he almost killed his wife, yet he continued even in distraction with fresh rage until he died delirious. In one murder trial that reached the Old Bailey in 1739, Catherine de May was accused of having put, quote, a great quantity of cantharides being a deadly poison into a certain liquor made of coffee and water boiled together, which she then gave to Michael Dunn, a young man living in the same household. Given their reputation as an aphrodisiac, several witnesses in the case felt it was very necessary to highlight that de May had not been acting out of lust or motivations of seduction, but had simply used the medicine as a poison. As it turned out, it was in his treatment for venereal disease and she hadn't done anything to him, but that didn't help her that much, as it turned out. Whether given in licit or illicit circumstances, aphrodisiacs, like all medicines, straddled the divide between food and medicine. All alimentary substances in the early modern thought possessed humoral qualities and thus had the potential to affect the workings of the body. And we return here to Felix Platter. I've given you one little column because the page, it's a double page spread, his list of aphrodisiacs. We've already seen he gives lots and lots of suggestions. As we've seen, after the numerous recommendations of aphrodisiacs that we've already discussed, Platter continues by listing several dishes that were traditionally made for their aphrodisiac virtues. You should be able to see them just towards the bottom of the column here. In particular, he noted that many of these were consumed on specific occasions, notably marriage, including the white broth called in Dutch bijnwarm, apologies for my pronunciations of other languages, made of wine, eggs, sugar and butter, with which the bridegroom restoreth himself in the morning. In addition, he recorded several other recipes, which were clearly consumed as foods, such as march pains, diverse junkets made of sugar, honey and spices given after supper at night, and the high Dutch bread lefrieken, which he noted was invented with the rest to provoke venery. But there's no suggestion in this text that these foods would have been experienced differently to the medical substances he's just been talking about. Indeed, immediately after this, Platter went straight back to discussing medical substances and listed seven different aphrodisiac powders, some pills, a syrup, numerous oils and ointments, all of which we can imagine might have had slightly different experiences between their taking, but he doesn't really discuss any of that. The lack of distinction between medical and alimentary substances in this era thus makes it difficult to understand the experience of consuming aphrodisiacs at this time. In fact, many of the aphrodisiacs that were listed were a part of the everyday diet, and so it would seem that they were regularly consumed without much thought at all for the effects they were having on the body. It's only given the right circumstances that they're transformed into titillating and in some cases concerning substances. For example, Nehemiah Wallington, the Puritan artisan, recorded in his diary that he was eating a nice selection of foods without much worry until one day his particularly lascivious thoughts about a maid started to give him some concern, and so he wrote down that he would stop eating eggs, oysters and wine, which he believed might be inflaming his libido and prompting his lustful, sinful thoughts. Laura Gianetti has shown that in early modern comedic plays, aphrodisiacs were usually consumed by old, lecherous husbands who failed to satisfy their young and beautiful brides. They were purchased and consumed in secret to mask the shame of the impotent and probably infertile bodies they signified. Yet the consumption of aphrodisiacs in medical texts was clearly focused on married couples, and in particular on women whose reproductive bodies were thought to fail more often than men's. In medical texts, the consumption of aphrodisiacs appears relatively uncomplicated by any notions of shame, although accepting that the reproductive body had failed and needed supplementing was probably a shameful experience. So, certain aphrodisiacs were experienced as tactile objects rather than consumed as foods or medicines. Phallic plants, as we've already seen, acted in accordance with the doctrine of signatures and were described predominantly in relation to their physicality. It was their shape, the erect fleshy stem with or without small bulbous roots, and the hairs on the roots often add to the appearance, which signified their potency. Carrots and parsnips, Philippa Puller has suggested, were considered stimulating because of their shape, although there's little evidence of this in the medical and herbal literature of the 17th century. They are recorded as aphrodisiacs for being windy and nutritious. And what I'm wondering at the moment is whether the doctrine of signatures was so well established that you didn't need to point out that a parsnip or a carrot was the right shape. Lawrence Totlin has drawn attention to the presence of numerous phallic vegetables in the original Hippocratic corpus of gynecological recipes. And for men writing medical texts who were perhaps well versed with those texts, I kind of think they knew and they didn't really think they needed to point it out because it was quite obvious. Given that shape was fundamental to their efficacy, it's perhaps unsurprising that it's these aphrodisiacs that get mentioned in relation to tactile experiences. Talking of satyrion, or dog stones, that we saw earlier, Kroll stated that it was so potent that it provoked lust simply being held in the hand. And Puller noted that the Romans had also believed that this was the case. The physicality of such aphrodisiacs was further elucidated in a plate inserted into the Voyage of Leith, which portrayed a woman in a kitchen masturbating with either a carrot or a parsnip. Here the plant served a dual function as an aphrodisiac and as a dildo, which I'm sure we're going to hear much more about. And indeed, it was perhaps thought to be much more suitable as a dildo because it was a substance that was known to be inherently sexually stimulating. I think it would be pushing it a little bit too far to say she's doing it for fertile purposes, because there's nothing in the text to support that. But the association, the knowledge of what carrots and parsnips do, I think perhaps influenced the choice a little bit. Aphrodisiacs that function through occult virtues could also be shaped into amulets and worn on the body in order to improve potency. Again, in this way, aphrodisiacs were engaged with much more readily as a physical object. William Williams' Book of Occult Physic, published in 1660, aimed to present the magical and physical virtues of plants, beasts, and herbs. In the book on beasts, Williams listed several animal plants that could be used to cause both impotence and barrenness, and that could be used to improve potency. He wrote of the roebuck, "Take the horns of him and make beads thereof, and wear them about your neck and wrists, and it causes conception. And if a man weareth the same, he shall not have his natural course of seed, though he lie with a woman." Horns in this case were perhaps the ideal substance to promote contrary effects. They were phallic in shape and associated with the potency of a young animal, particularly one that might grow into a stag. But they were also the symbol of cuckoldry, and so inherently associated with impotence and sexual failure. And so I think that might be the reason it's being used in this dual way. Aphrodisiac charms were also used to counteract infertility magic, although more often than not, medical writers preferred patients to approach infertility magic with a purely natural, medicinal treatment, form of treatment in mind. Nicholas Culpepper's translation of Lazarus Reverius's Practice of Physic explained that the pizzle, or penis of a wolf worn on a woman's body, would frustrate incantations and protect her fertility and sexual ability. Likewise, this text recommended that man and wife should wear the root of Aringo, which you can see on the screen here, which is another very popular early modern aphrodisiac. These types of aphrodisiac use were probably quite limited in England, as there were few reports of infertility magic. However, they do demonstrate that aphrodisiacs could be engaged with as physical objects, as objects that were shaped and adapted to be worn on the body. And in this case, it's their physical proximity to the body that makes them efficacious. Importantly, I think this emphasises that aphrodisiacs don't have to be eaten to preserve, protect, and enhance the body's sexual and reproductive potential. And one final way in which I think we can see this, and which represents another form of interaction with aphrodisiacs as substances, is the use of unguents and lotions. In these cases, certain aphrodisiacs were deployed in a medicinal sense, but were not consumed as food or consumed within the body. Somewhat like the carrot in the Voyage to Leith, certain aphrodisiacs could be applied to the male body, which then functioned as a form of pessary, delivering medical and aphrodisiac qualities inside the woman's womb. Jane Jackson recorded in her medical text a series of remedies that worked in this way. The first of which, she said, "Take the brain of a crane and meddle it with gander's grease and fox grease and keep it in a vessel of gold or silver. And at what time thou would have knowledge, anoint therewith thy yard and she shall conceive." Both medical writers and recipe collectors recommended dual remedies like this that were applied to the male and female body. In a second recipe, Jackson instructed, take the juice of satyrion, that is cock's pintle, and anoint thy yard, and the woman's privity also, and strain above powder made of matrix of the hair, and then deal with her, and she shall conceive. Likewise, in print, Nicholas Fontanus's The Woman's Doctor suggested that when a man and a woman intend conjunction, let him anoint his yard with oil of mastic and wormwood mingled with a few grains of musk and civet, and let the woman also anoint her privy parts therewith, as well within as without, for by this means there is raised a mutual inclination to venery, and the seed is received with greater pleasure, and it's more duly retained and elaborated. You can see again there the really close connection between fertility and pleasure. The application of these substances was perhaps a very different experience to consuming food-based stimulants, because it encouraged intimacy and foreplay, with partners engaging in tactile contact with each other's genitals. The language used by some medical writers, though, was often not very clear about what was going on in these cases. Many were quite clear that a man should anoint himself. They're far less clear about who should be anointing the woman. And some of them just say, let her be anointed with, which, you know, that could be anyone. Very rarely do they say that she should be doing it to herself. What I think is really interesting about this is that some even go so far as to suggest that this is a secret and that the woman shouldn't even know what's happening. And so Felix Platter's medical treatise stated that privately, before copulation, let the man anoint his yard with civet or the gall of a hen. And so we can see here aphrodisiacs being used as a kind of secret remedy for whatever a man's purpose might be. But I think what's really interesting about that is we could perhaps contrast it to the ballads we saw earlier, where it's always women giving men aphrodisiacs. And in this case, it's a man potentially giving a woman an aphrodisiac, although it would also be working on his own body. So to conclude, because I've waffled on for quite long enough, In modern society, we tend to think of aphrodisiacs purely as foods and purely as things that stimulate sexual desire. They are, to many people, sexual curiosities, things that cause laughter and a little bit of a joke. And while they were sexual curiosities to early modern people, and certainly did cause laughter in early modern society, they were also much more complex to them than they are to us. They were substances that were ingested, smeared upon the body, they were consumed privately or given publicly, and they were parts in part secretive and shameful, and both open and public. They were prepared medicinally and consumed as sustenance, and their function shifted with context, depending on whether someone was worried about their lascivious thoughts or were worried about infertility. Despite being ephemeral, then, they've left us some traces from which we could start to disentangle how these were things that might truly matter. After all, they could be the difference between a life of ridicule and shame as a barren couple and the joy of parenthood. And if nothing else, they truly mattered because they improved, or at least were thought to improve, couples' sex lives. Thank you very much.